a pleasure to be here. I'm learning a lot, and maybe this talk is probably going to be the odd one out today. It's at least half experimental, but there will be a little bit of math toward the end. And I'm kind of gauging from some of the challenges I've had picking up things that have been talked about quickly. I'm imagining maybe the experimental background to make heads or tails of some of the things early in this talk may not be there for everyone. I'm very happy to be interrupted. I don't want to go through it and say things that don't mean anything. So if you have questions at the beginning, please just stop me and ask. Okay, so the title, Simulation Complexity of Circuits with Random Geometries. This work, so first of all, it was done on the theoretical side largely with these two collaborators at Quantinuum. And the goal of this work was really that we build these quantum computers based on trapped ion qubits. And one of the key capabilities that they have is the ability to implement circuits with essentially arbitrary geometries. And the reason we can do that is that our qubits are not, you know, living in any particular space. Our qubits, and I'll say more about what they are, they hover above the surface of this kind of microfabricated trap. So this thing is just some, you know, substrate with gold electrodes printed on the top of it. And you can see this kind of ring here. And, you know, tens of microns above the surface of that gold, these ions live kind of, you know, along that one-dimensional ring. And we can, you know, apply voltages to these electrodes that essentially sculpt, you know, the potential landscape above the surface of the trap. They're charged atoms, so they feel, you know, the electric potentials of those electrodes. And by dynamically controlling those voltages and moving the potential, you know, landscape around, imagine taking a trap and just kind of shifting it like that, we can drag the ions around this ring, and we can dynamically reposition them so that any arbitrary qubits are next to each other so that you can apply quantum gates between them. And so one of the things this motivated us to look at is if you take circuits with complicated geometries, say in comparison to the types of 2D circuits that people have used for recent quantum advantage demonstrations, what does that actually buy you? What are the implications of that from a complexity of simulation standpoint? Okay, our qubits are singly ionized ytterbium-171 ions. Maybe a show of hands so I have some context. Who, without me saying it, who has any idea what this is? Oh, actually, a lot of people. Okay, good. All right, then maybe I'll go a little quicker than I thought I would. So the so this is basically the ground state electronic structure of this ytterbium ion. It has a spin 1/2 valence electron. It has a spin 1/2 nucleus. So together, they give you four states. And the only thing important is that these two middle states, people call it a clock state. And the reason for that is just they have a very stable frequency difference. So if you put an ion in a superposition of these two states, it'll oscillate at a very well-defined frequency. And one measure of how stable that is what we call this T2 or coherence time. This just means if you put, you know, a qubit in the plus X state and you look a certain amount of time later, what's the probability of finding it in the correct superposition? That time scale is about 10 seconds. And for us, that's long enough that it's almost infinite. You can kind of ignore that there's any decoherence of that type. And let's see. So I have just been putting these slides together recently because the data I'll show you is basically from this week. And I didn't know how far I would get through the slides, so I wanted to remember to thank the experimental team who's actually doing a lot of this work. All these people work on this so-called H2 quantum computer that I'm showing a picture of, but there's actually many tens of additional people, engineers and other physicists that are all working to build these devices. Okay. So here's a more close-up view of what these ions look like. So again, they're hovering over the surface of this trap. And when we want to apply quantum operations to these qubits, there's really only four places that we can do it. So we shine laser beams over the surface of the trap that, say, intersect at this point, and we can use those lasers to do, you know, single qubit, two qubit gates, state preparation and measurement, all the quantum operations you'd want to do. When we first launched this as a commercial product, so a kind of publicly available quantum computer, it had 32 qubits, but you can kind of imagine, you know, this device is not tied to any particular number of qubits. If you want to load more qubits into the trap, you're free to do that. It just makes all the transport you want to do a little more complicated. So what I'll talk about today is some preliminary data with loading now 56 qubits into the trap. One minor complication is that it's actually 112 ions, And the reason for that is that in order to do gates with high fidelity on a device like this, you have to be able to keep the qubits cold as you move them around, so motionally cold. And it's you can't really do that by directly laser cooling them without destroying the qubit you know, in that ion. So what we do is we co-trap another species of ion, in this case barium. And you can laser cool the barium at frequencies that the qubit doesn't know about. It doesn't see at all. And then you can sympathetically cool the ions to keep them cold enough to do high fidelity gates. So I'm just showing a simplified view, ignoring all of that with just the qubits. And let me now show you how a circuit would look on just a simple example with a few qubits located in two of these, what I'll call gate zones, these locations where we can apply gates. Okay, so here are a few qubits, red, green, and blue, and here's a quantum circuit that you might want to run on those qubits. And initially I'll draw them located like this in the trap. So when you want to now apply these single qubit gates, I'm sorry, this was just showing them being prepared in a particular internal state. And then when you want to apply these single qubit gates, so they're sitting in gate zones where that can be done. It's done with individual addressing by lasers. The next thing in the circuit is that a two qubit gate is meant to be implemented between the red and the green ion. So for us, this length scale is quite large. It's large enough that the ions don't talk very strongly to each other. So if you want to do two qubit gates, you have to merge them together into a single potential well. So the first step for a gate is you drag the ion over the surface of the trap, and then you merge the two ions into the exact same, you know, harmonic confining potential. So now they're only maybe a micron apart, and they're coupled together by the Coulomb interaction very efficiently, and that interaction can mediate a gate. So we do sort of a relatively standard gate that was thought about in the late 90s probably, called the Molnar-Sorensen gate, that employs the Coulomb interaction as the underlying mechanism of interaction. Okay. So again, this Molnar-Sorensen gate, it's basically laser-based. I'll tell you some of the details about the fidelities that are achieved. And now, if you look at this circuit, the next thing you'd want to do is gate the first and the third qubit. So nominally, it looks like these things live in 1D, and that shouldn't be possible directly. But the reason that's not the case is that we can actually swap them around each other. Okay, so they can be kind of dragged out of this 1D line. And in that way, we can put the first and third qubit next to each other and, again, directly implement this two-qubit gate. Okay. Something I'll point out is that we also have the capability to do measurement in the middle of a circuit. That's largely facilitated by the fact that a qubit to be measured can be spatially isolated from the rest of them, so you can measure it without destroying all the other qubits. And when we do that, we also have the ability to then classically condition any result of that or any future gates on the result of that measurement in real time. So this is a, you know, obviously a useful thing to be able to do from the standpoint of quantum error correction, where you might want to measure some syndromes and then update your future circuit depending on the answer you got. Okay. So here's how, you know, that would look in a more complicated non-3 qubit circuit. So we have all these 56 qubits, and imagine, you know, you hand a description of a circuit to this machine, and the gates can be applied to any qubit. Say there's a first, you know, round of gates where all the qubits are gated in pairs. And okay, you know, you might call for qubit 1 to be gated with qubit 27. It doesn't matter. We'll just assign qubits 1 and 27, those labels, to two ions that happen to be next to each other at the beginning of the circuit. Okay, so the first round of gates always just looks like taking the ions as they exist in the trap and just rotating them through the gate zones in batches of 8 like this and applying all of the gates one after another. So that's one round of gates that's kind of illustrated up here. For an arbitrary circuit, the next round of gates might look like nothing in particular, right? You now have sort of random pairs with relation to the original layout of the qubits. And so what we do is we take this random assignment of gates and we run a sorting algorithm that decides where to place the qubits so that all gated qubits are now actually co-located in the trap. So we just repeat all that swapping and moving around until the qubits are completely rearranged to make it possible to execute all of these gates directly. Now they're laid out in some different way in the trap, and again, we just kind of Rolodex them through in batches of 4 gates at a time until all of these gates are applied. And then you can imagine just repeating this for many layers with arbitrary gates. Okay. So a few things to point out. There's a lot of details of this actually published online. I think I have an archive reference in one of the slides coming up. But I'll just call your attention to a couple of the performance metrics. So the dominant source of error in this machine is, like in most quantum hardware, is the 2-qubit gates. And this fidelity is reported as, it's weird units of 10 to the minus 4. You can think of it as basically, you know, if you apply this gate 1,000 times, it does the right thing 998 times, and two of those times it spits out garbage. So that's kind of what that number means. The other important source of error in circuits is a little more complicated. So I mentioned initially that qubits, when they're just idle, have this 10-second coherence time. That's not actually infinite compared to our circuit times. It does cause a little bit of error. And we characterize it in the following way. So we take a random circuit like this. So this is a circuit where you're going to gate a bunch of pairs of qubits, and then you're going to apply single qubit gates, and then you're going to randomly permute the qubits before applying another round of gates to them. So this is just kind of a circuit with completely random structure. And what we do is we run the circuit, except we delete all the 2-qubit gates. And then, you know, because the 2-qubit gates are deleted, every single qubit just sees a series of single qubit gates, so you know what state it should come out in, and you can just measure the probability that it came out in the right state. And from that probability, you can infer the probability that an error happened during a circuit that looked like this. We call this transport 1QRB. Essentially, what it's trying to do is just measure all of these potential sources of error from single qubit gates, from just the idling or the motion of the ions, basically everything other than the 2-qubit gates, and package it all together into a single number. And that's this 2 times 10 to the minus 4. The fact that it's a lot smaller than this is why, kind of to zeroth order, when I say that the memory error doesn't matter, that's just a quantitative way of telling you how much it doesn't matter. And you can kind of, you know, in a circuit that looks like this, you can lump these two things together to think about an effective error per 2-qubit gate in the circuit, most of which, you know, 1.80 minus 3 comes from the 2-qubit gate itself, and a little bit of extra error comes from other stuff happening in the circuit during all this transport. And, you know, we've gone through pretty great pains to understand the extent to which, when you run complicated circuits, those two errors that I just claimed were dominant are actually the whole story. And so you don't need to understand what these things are if you don't already know. It doesn't really matter. These are just some complicated circuits that, as a result of their random structure, from the output of these circuits, you can infer with some level of confidence what the probability of failure per 2-qubit gate in the circuit was from the measured data. And that's you know, what these numbers here are, and we can compare that to, you know, just adding up these, you know, these kind of component benchmarking numbers, and we can see that we generally get pretty good agreement. So this is kind of a way of showing that when you know, we claim these fidelities on the individual components, when you run a complicated circuit with all of those components interleaved together, what comes out is actually reflecting the fidelities that we quote. And that's going to be important for some of the claims I'll make about the fidelities of circuits that are quite complicated and I'll try to argue are hard to simulate. Okay, so many of you are probably familiar with the idea of random circuit sampling. This was a proposal for demonstrating quantum advantage that goes back mostly to the work of the Google group. And the idea is relatively straightforward. So basically, you take a bunch of qubits, put them in the zero state, and apply some random unitary to them, and then measure all the qubits at the output of the circuit. You get a bunch of zeros and ones, so you get some bit string like this. And now you repeat that a bunch of times, and it turns out that for random circuits, there's a lot of structure in the probabilities of these different bit strings. They're not all uniform, so they'll be distributed according to this so-called Porter-Thomas distribution. But the important thing is that because the probability of different bit strings varies quite a bit, you can subject the data that comes out to statistical tests, which basically are a measure of, you know, did the bit strings that were more likely come out more often, or did the bit strings I receive tend to kind of, you know, accumulate around higher probabilities as they should when sampling from a distribution. And so, you know, Google used this kind of statistical test of linear XCB, but there's other ways of doing it. The important point is just that you can, you know, you can subject the outputs that you get to a test that basically tells you whether they were faithfully drawn from the circuit that you were supposed to run. And the reason why this is, you know, considered a good task for demonstrating quantum advantage is that it's generally believed that at least if you score high enough on the statistical test, or equivalently, if the fidelity with which you implement this circuit is high enough, either on a quantum computer or through classical simulation. You know, the only way that you could achieve such a high score is basically to do something that's just as hard as directly simulating the quantum circuit, which is something that for sufficiently complicated circuits, we don't expect to be possible classically, or at least to scale poorly, you know, exponentially with n, the number of qubits. Okay, so this is the idea of random circuit sampling. In practice, what's always been done is to, you know, decompose, you know, this, you know, quote unquote random unitary into a bunch of random gates in some fixed geometry. So here, just because it's easy to draw, I'm showing what you might do in 1D. If you had just nearest neighbor gates, you might apply, you know, rows of 2-qubit gates, interspersed between them, you might have, say, hard random, you know, SU2 gates or something applied to the qubits. So this is some approximation to a random unitary that's not exactly hard random. In fact, it turns out not to be a good idea to do this in 1D, and so what people have done for existing random circuit sampling experiments is to do this in 2D. That's what Google and other groups have done. And what I'll talk about today is how we are utilizing this kind of flexible connectivity afforded by being able to move these ions around to implement circuits with random geometries. And so the way that we actually write down circuits with random geometries looks like this. So basically, we start with a random graph. And if you want a circuit that's depth d, so d layers of 2-qubit gates on n qubits, we randomly sample a d-regular graph on n nodes. So this is the this example here is for 6 qubits at depth 3. So that would be a graph with 6 nodes, and it has to be 3 regulars. So 3 edges coming out of every vertex as drawn. Okay, so we randomly sample such a graph. Now we assign it an edge coloring, which can generally be done with d or sometimes d plus 1, but generally only d colors, where d is the degree, so 3 in this case. So here these 3 colors are just assigned to the edges in such a way that no 2 edges of the same color are incident on any node. So that's what I mean by an edge coloring. And the reason that this kind of induces a depth D circuit on n qubits is that, you know, if I think of every edge as being a 2-qubit gate between qubits assigned to the nodes, the fact that no 2 edges of the same color are incident on any node means that I can always implement all the gates of a given color in a single layer of a circuit. So I can think of now the, you know, 3 colors in this graph is corresponding to 3 layers of 2-qubit gates in a quantum circuit, now of depth 3. Okay, so that's the mapping. And then, so the geometry is random. The gates are also random in the following sense. The 2-qubit gates are more or less equivalent to a control Z gate, so it's a perfect entangler. And the single-qubit gates, we just use hard random SU2 gates applied to the qubits in between all the rounds of 2-qubit gates. So this is the kind of circuit geometry I'll be talking about for the rest of the talk. Okay, and you know what I'm going to argue is that the cost of simulating these circuits classically would be very high, and you know, not without any awareness that most of the times people make claims like this, they kind of get, you know, more or less chased by an angry mob, and these kind of claims tend not to stand up super well over time. But, you know, let me try to say something maybe somewhat uncontroversial, which is that for, you know, if you take a circuit with, you know, no real structure, the best general purpose way to simulate that structure, and what I mean, that circuit, and what I mean by simulate now, it could be one of two things. It could be sample from the output distribution induced by the circuit, so to basically, like, pretend you're measuring. Or it could be something slightly stronger, which is often a subroutine used in sampling, simulations of sampling, which is to compute the probabilities of individual bit strings that come out of the circuit. And the best general purpose method to do that I'm aware of is optimized tensor network contraction. So you formulate the quantum circuit as a tensor network, and then you find an optimal way to contract that tensor network to obtain a probability. Okay. So if that is true, I think we have pretty good evidence, and I believe it is, I think we have pretty good evidence that these circuits are very hard to simulate, and not just that, they're hard to simulate in a regime where they can be implemented with very high fidelity. So the right classical simulation to compare them to would be near exact simulation, basically. Okay. All right, so let me describe what I mean by tensor network contraction. I think probably many people are familiar with this, but here's a very kind of quick warm-up. So Here is a rank one tensor. So it's drawn, you know, because it's rank one, it has a single index. That index is drawn as a line. So this thing is just a vector. In all of the cases we'll look at, these lines carry an index that ranges over two values because they'll describe qubits for the most part, right? So zero or one. So this is a vector with two components, zero component and one component. And, you know, in a tensor network diagram, it's just a diagrammatic language for expressing generalizations of things like inner product between vectors. So this diagram represents the inner product of these two vectors. And the reason it's an inner product is that any legs that join two tensors have to be summed over. That's what the notation implies. Okay, so this little diagram just means take u dot v. And you can generalize this, you know, in many different ways. So if you wanted to take the inner product of two vectors on sides of a matrix, it would look like this, where now a matrix is represented as a rank two tensor, so a thing with two legs coming out of it. Or, you know, in this example, this kind of diagram would be the trace of the product of three matrices. And then you can generalize this to, you know, many more complicated things with arbitrary rank tensors. But that's what this language means. So here's an example of a more complicated looking tensor network. And one thing I want to emphasize is that the classical cost of computing a tensor network is very, very dependent on the order in which you start contracting the tensors. And, you know, one way to see that is to imagine trying to do kind of a bottom to top contraction of this tensor network. So what I mean is you would first try to sum over all the indices joining the tensors on the bottom half to, you know, come up with some kind of, you know, joint tensor with that has a rank, which is now determined by the number of legs coming out of this white blob. So I've drawn a red dot everywhere there's a leg exiting this blob. And it's pretty easy to convince yourself that just the cost of storing a general tensor like that should be exponential in the number of red dots at the boundary, and also the cost of doing any operations with it, like applying other gates or absorbing other tensors into it, will also scale exponentially with the number of legs exiting the boundary. And so this is a relatively bad contraction order. It would be better to contract from left to right, because now you can proceed always with fewer legs exiting the boundary of the tensor. So there are often, you know, much, much better or much worse ways to contract the same network. Okay, so this is the connection now to quantum circuits. Think about the circuit here. This is just a one-dimensional circuit, so time is moving up. So the qubit wires go like this, and all of these green things are two-qubit gates. And I'm just showing an example in 1D, even though that's not what we'll be really looking at. And to convert this into a tensor network is very straightforward. It basically is just like, in this kind of graphical notation, it's almost obvious. A two-qubit gate has two wires coming in and two wires going out. You can think of this as, say, a 4x4 matrix, but you can also think of it as a rank 4 tensor, right, with four legs, each of which has two indices, 0, 1. So two incoming legs for the two qubits, two outgoing legs for the two qubits. And just drawing those tensors now as dots, this circuit can be converted into a tensor network that just looks like this, the one in the middle here. And there's one little complication, honestly, that's not very important, but I'll just state what it is because it helps with describing some of what comes later. It's nice to have a representation where the qubit wires and the gates that are applied to the qubits are all represented by edges of the tensor network. And that can always be done because you can take these tensors, these rank 4 gate tensors, and you can use singular value decomposition to decompose them into the union or the contraction of two rank 3 tensors like this. Honestly, it really doesn't matter. The important thing is that now we have a tensor network where every qubit corresponds to an edge and every gate also corresponds to an edge. So that's the mapping I have in mind. And, you know, I talked on the previous slide about the cost of contraction, and we can think about this now in the context of this very structured tensor network. So if you start grouping together a bunch of tensors and trying to kind of merge them through contraction into larger tensors, the cost will be exponential in kind of the size of the boundary of whatever object you form. And this can be related pretty simply to, you know, some things I'm sure everybody knows about. So one is that there's one contraction strategy, which is to go from bottom to top, so to move in a time-like direction. And to do that, when you've joined all the tensors below this line, you'll always have a number of indices kind of crossing your tensor that is equal to the number of qubits. And what this tensor is just the wave function at that point in the circuit, right? And so it's no surprise that this number of, you know, complex entries you need for a wave function is going to be 2 to the number of qubits. And that's exactly a statement of, you know, that I'm making when I say this tensor now has n edges sticking out of it. Okay, so this is basically a strategy that corresponds to just brute force evolution of the wave function by applying gates to it and storing it as a 2 to the n dimensional complex vector. But there's, you know, for shallow circuits, there's a much better strategy, which is to contract them sideways. And you could imagine that, you know, now instead of cutting qubit wires, you're essentially cutting gates. These horizontal edges came from, you know, SV being the gates in the original circuit. And the number of gates you have to cut to draw a line up through your circuit is just proportional to the circuit depth. So the cost of contracting a 1D circuit sideways is not exponential in the qubit number, it's only exponential in the circuit depth. And this is why shallow 1D circuits are essentially always easy to simulate, even for a large qubit number. Okay, so this can easily be generalized to beyond 1D. And instead of exponential in depth, it now becomes exponential in depth to some polynomial of the number of qubits, which, if you think about what this actually is, where capital D is the number of spatial dimensions, this is just the kind of hypersurface area of a plane that bisects the spacetime volume of your quantum circuit. And so here, I'll draw it. I have an example that's actually drawn. So this is the case of a 2 plus 1 dimensional quantum circuit. So the length of my system is now square root of n in this case, because D is 2. And if I imagine kind of contracting the tensor network from left to right, what I need to do to understand the cost is I need to look at the number of bonds that kind of, or the number of edges in the tensor network that exit this kind of, you know, division of the tensor network. And that's going to scale like the surface area of this bisecting hypersurface. So in 2D, that's just going to be, you know, n over d, which is l, to the d minus 1. So that's, you know, this L dimension, and then times the vertical dimension, which is always the depth. And then you can imagine how this would be generalized to higher dimensions. So let me see. So I guess this, yeah, I think I can finish by 5. Okay, so a convenient way to think about an actual, like, you know, a convenient measure of the cost of contracting the tensor network is as follows. So it looks a little funny, but it has a very simple interpretation. So anytime you contract a tensor network, you know, under the hood in a computer, what you're doing is just a bunch of multiplications and additions. And so we can just count up the floating point operations, that's the flops, that it takes to contract the tensor network. And when we do that, you know, we'll get some answer. We can divide it by the number of gates in the circuit and take log base 2 of the answer. And we'll call this script n. And I'll call n an effective qubit number. And the motivation for that is as follows. You can just invert this equation, and you'll see that the cost in floating point operations is 2 to the n times the number of gates. And that is exactly the cost you'd expect for just evolving the wave function of n particles kind of by brute force, by just storing it as a 2 to the n dimensional vector and applying gates to it. And that's just because you'd have to apply this number of gates, and each one is basically a sparse matrix multiplication by a 2 to the n dimensional vector. Okay, so what this n is basically saying is that your circuit, you know, it may have an actual qubit number that is larger than script n. It's not guaranteed to actually reach this value. But regardless, that circuit is only as hard to simulate as the worst case simulation cost, so this kind of brute force wave function evolution on script n qubits. Okay, so that's what's meant by this. And just for some context, what you can achieve on kind of state-of-the-art superconductors ends up converting more or less into being able to simulate at n equals 56, so the number of qubits that we currently have, on the timescale of kind of hundreds of seconds, roughly, to do exact simulations. So maybe not absolutely impossible, although I think this is actually, this hundreds of seconds is actually a fairly conservative lower bound, and you can imagine it doesn't scale very well as you increase n, so you start adding qubits and it gets a lot worse very quickly. Okay, so one more little piece of notation is to take this script n and normalize it by the number of qubits you actually have in your circuit. So I'll call this a complexity density. And, you know, the motivation for that is that now the cost in flops is 2 to the script C times the number of qubits. And so basically script C is telling you what fraction of your qubits are contributing to the worst case, you know, scaling of simulation that you could have for n qubits. So when C is 1, it tells you that your if, you know, for a particular circuit or a particular tensor network, if C is 1, it's telling you that basically your circuit is deep and complicated enough that there's nothing better you can do than just write out the full wave function and evolve it, which will have this kind of 2 to the 56 type scaling for 56 qubits. Okay. Now, going back to the statements I made about contraction costs, if you write this complexity density in that language, what you find is that, first of all, it can never be larger than one. Kind of by definition, it can never be larger than one. If the circuit is insufficiently deep, it can be much less than one, because you know one is kind of assuming that you have to do this time-like progression of the tensor network contraction, but if it's sufficiently shallow, there will be a better path moving sideways with lower cost. And you know this ratio here is basically just the surface area of a spatial bipartition of the you know space-time volume of the circuit normalized by the number of qubits. Okay. So this is where these you know, random graphs come in. For a random graph, so now this is you know, some graph on 56 qubits that might, I think I drew it for depth 4, so it comes from a 4 regular graph. And again, every edge corresponds to a gate that will be applied at some layer of the circuit between the qubits it connects. And there is no real notion of you know, a sort of hypersurface area for a bipartition, but there's a related notion, which is you could you know, try to cut the system like this, and you could ask what the edge boundary is of a bipartition. So how many edges go from one side of this bipartition to the other? And if you take the size of an edge boundary and you normalize it by n, it turns out that this is a well-known graph theoretic property called the isoperimetric number of the graph. And so this I of g. And it was proven, this is probably in the, maybe in the late 80s or even 90s, that the isoperimetric number of random regular graphs is with high probability for large graphs bounded below by a constant. And so what that means is, in our language, this complexity density is bounded above by a constant, in particular does not go to zero as n goes to infinity, which is what you would expect to happen in any kind of finite dimensional geometry. So by being able to generate these random graph circuits, we can maintain this kind of fixed complexity density even for very large qubit numbers and at relatively shallow depths. That's the upshot of what this theorem means. And I'll show you some numerics that support this. So what we have also done is to actually use just open source packages that exist for trying to contract tensor networks or find optimal contraction orders of tensor networks, to take circuits and try to estimate the minimal cost upon optimizing over all possible contraction orders of their tensor networks. You can only do this heuristically, but the heuristics are actually generally pretty good. And so this is a plot of what you get for the complexity density, this quantity C, plotted as a function of qubit number and circuit depth if you run this kind of a calculation. And first thing you'll notice is that for 2D circuits, I said this complexity density should be asymptotically 1 at sufficiently large depths, but for depths that are less than square root of n, it will be something less than that, meaning that not every qubit contributes to the worst case simulation cost. And so in this plot, you know, another way of seeing this is that when the depth is sufficiently shallow that this is less than 1, the contours of kind of equal computational cost should be scaling like d comparable to the square root of n. And if you plot this on a log plot, you can see that that is actually, on a log-log plot, that's sort of what the contours do. So, you know, this heuristic is generating kind of the expected geometrical behavior of this complexity density for a 2D tensor network. We can plot the same thing now for a random tensor network, and we also get good kind of heuristic evidence for this lower bound that I mentioned, that based on this kind of result about graph isoperimetric numbers, this complexity density is constant as n goes to infinity. And that's just reflected by these contours being flat. So this is saying if you take a circuit at fixed depth and start adding more and more qubits, the ratio, the fraction of the qubits that contribute to the actual simulation cost is staying bounded below by a constant, or really just staying constant. And you know, the upshot of what this random geometry gets you is really just the fact that as you go at any fixed qubit number up in depth, you reach this kind of black region of the plot, which is you know C equals 1. So this is where every qubit is contributing to the simulation cost. You reach it at much lower depths than you would in any finite dimensional geometry. And so one consequence of that is that we can execute circuits that should be hard to simulate at much lower depth, and therefore, since every kind of added layer of gates causes some infidelity, ultimately that translates into being able to execute hard to simulate circuits with higher fidelity. And you know the reason that that's important is that probably the single most difficult to close loophole in some of these kind of quantum supremacy demonstrations that have been made is the fact that they typically operate at overall circuit fidelities that are at about, say, 0.01 to 0.1%. So they're kind of in that range. And there are many different approximate simulation techniques that one could try to apply to achieve comparable fidelities. So by being able to run hard to exactly simulate circuits at fidelities much closer to one, we hope to kind of close some of these loopholes and really rule out approximate simulation methods. Okay. So I said that, we can achieve relatively high fidelities because these circuits become hard at such low depth. I'm going to give you some actual evidence that really comes from data that is being taken like now, essentially, that's true. And the way we estimate the fidelity of these circuits is by a technique known as mirror benchmarking. And it's a relatively simple idea. So take the circuit, and you want to know what is the state fidelity at the output of this circuit, so the state at this dashed line. And the way you estimate it is you append another circuit to it that's just the time-reversed version of the circuit you care about. And so ideally, what should happen is if there is no noise, every gate should get undone, and you should come out in the exact same state that you went in, right? So if you put in the qubits like this, you should measure at the output 0, 1, 1, 0, 1, 0. And it turns out that under pretty reasonable assumptions, the probability that that happens is a good measure of the actual fidelity of the circuit. And there's a bunch of things that one can do to try to boost your confidence in those assumptions. One of them, one way this could completely fail is, for example, what if this circuit just never implemented, the gates in this layer in both the forward and backward circuit? It would still amount to a logical identity. So even though you thought there was, what you would get out at the top is still the thing you put in, but it was actually just the wrong circuit, right? It didn't have the right gates in it. So to rule out these kind of effects, we also apply a technique known as randomized compiling, which is basically a way to try to prevent mirrored coherent errors from canceling out in a way that would not let you observe their effects. It makes sure that they're turned into incoherent errors that result in a diminished probability of ending up in the right state. And so we've done simulations of this procedure using a detailed error model of our device, and you get curves that look like this. So what I'm showing here, there's really just three things to pay attention to. The first, this black curve, is just an actual simulation of the fidelity using a sort of careful device noise model. And it's showing it as a function of circuit depth. So it does kind of the expected thing. The deeper the circuit, the lower the fidelity of the state that comes out, which makes sense. And then this dotted line down here is this kind of simple argument based on this effective 2-qubit gate error I mentioned earlier. So we know what this is from component benchmarks in our machine. And we can say, there's sort of a very simple way of thinking about the probability of getting, or of the state fidelity, which is that if no errors occur, then the state is what it should have been. And if even a single error occurred anywhere in the circuit, if the circuit is sufficiently complicated, the state that should come out after that error has happened should be completely uncorrelated with the correct state. So it should be, have fidelity zero with respect to the correct state. So if that's true, then the fidelity of the state should be pretty well estimated by just taking the probability that no gate has failed. And that's what this factor is right here. So this is just the fidelity per 2-qubit gate raised to the power of the number of 2-qubit gates. That's the probability of no errors in the circuit. And so first, that line is a pretty good estimate of the actual fidelity in this noise model. We also simulate this, mirror benchmarking procedure, and that's what's shown in pink up here. So you see that it also agrees pretty well with the actual fidelity. And even this kind of, the fact that this gate counting argument comes in a little low and this mirror benchmarking technique comes in a little high, that can actually all be understood in some level of detail. It's kind of expected physics. We can't do these simulations at large circuit sizes, but you can do them at a variety of small circuit sizes and see that you get good kind of scaling collapse. So basically, if you keep the probability of an error happening in any layer of the circuit fixed as you change the qubit number, you can see that the simulated fidelity becomes independent in that model of the qubit number. And so it's not so crazy to think, here I've, changed n over a factor of 3. If you pushed it by another factor of 2 and a little more up to 56, it's pretty credible. I think the fidelity curve would look something like this. It would still agree with this gate counting model. And we can do the same kind of simulation for mirror benchmarking. So basically, all of this numerics is just to justify that mirror benchmarking data, even out at 56 qubits, is likely to be a pretty good estimator of circuit fidelity. Okay, so coming to the end of my talk, here is some data from now. Preliminary meaning, you know, like if I screwed up and something's wrong, don't hold me to it, but I think it's right. And so what this is showing is this return probability to the correct state, so this mirror benchmarking estimate of the circuit fidelity as a function of circuit depth. And this, you know, line here, roughly around 12, it was really motivated by this plot, you know, here that once you get out to 12, C is pretty well saturated to 1, and that means that the cost of simulating the system is basically just the cost of doing full wave function evolution, which at 56 qubits is maybe not impossible, but starting to kind of encroach on impossible, I would say. And I think the exciting thing is that this hardware is now at sufficiently high fidelity, and because of this complicated geometry, these circuits are at sufficiently low depth, that these numbers are actually pretty large, right? So this is an overall circuit fidelity. For example, this point here is saying that when you execute this computationally hard circuit, you know, it executes without any error happening anywhere on any of the gates about 30% of the time. And I think this is now starting to become kind of a high enough number that it becomes pretty plausible that there are no good approximate methods for doing these simulations, and that we really do understand the complexity of simulating them through exact methods. So with that, I'll wrap up. I'm happy to take any questions.
Thank Mike for the great talk. Any questions?
Yeah, thanks for the talk. So you mentioned earlier that you have the ability to do classical feed forward within your computation. Is that just kind of the plain bits, or can you do computation on them as well, as you would need to do for measurement-based quantum computation, for example?
Yeah, so you can do essentially arbitrary computations. So what you can do is you can request a measurement in the middle of a circuit, and you can, you know, along with the description of the circuit, you can pass a classical program that then takes in, you know, a binary, you know, string, like the result of those measurements, and it runs like arbitrary functions, say that you wrote in C or something like that, right? And then it outputs, you know, any kind of, you know, basically, you know, anything you want that would allow you to then condition future gates on the result. So the answer is you can do relatively complicated stuff by passing along complicated classical functions. If you want to do like, you know, a complicated algorithm for you know, trying to decode errors in a quantum error correcting code, it is possible to do that.
Thanks.
Yep.
More questions?
I have a question.
Yep.
So in your analysis, you're proposing random graphs because they're easy to analyze and there are known results for those. But if you want to design a circuit that's hard, you could pick not a random graph, but one which has a bad contraction behavior, right? Don't you do that?
Yeah, yeah. So we did think about that in some level of detail. So I would say of the couple of things we tried, we did not find anything that was appreciably better than average case behavior of random graphs. I think there might be small improvements you could get, but we didn't find any evidence of large improvements. If there were graphs that had large improvements, that would be pretty interesting. But we weren't able to find any. So we kind of defaulted to this random graph thing because it was almost as good as anything we could find. And it also seemed like if you introduce structure to make the graph more complicated, you might also accidentally make other, you know, some other technique work better. So it seemed a little dangerous. But yeah.
Thank you. Related to me, Miriam's question. So I have a question about architecture in the future. When you make your racetrack trap just bigger, you will proportionally spend more time and more shuttling. Yeah, and so your gate fidelities, your effective gate fidelities will go down. So that maybe that can go on for a while, but not forever. And so what are your thoughts for future generations of the hardware?
Yeah, okay. So I really like this question. I mean, it's a great point. I think I'll answer with like two things. One, I fully agree. And there's no plans to make a one-dimensional trap that's bigger than this. That's not really part of our plans for exactly the reason you're saying. I think a lot of what this work is showing is that, yes, you can push this not forever, but to some scale. And this is showing that at least at this scale, you can still push it. to really go further, you know, I think there's pretty good reason to think that at the very least, you need to have kind of like, you know, fundamentally 2D geometry. So you'd really want to put these qubits, you know, in two dimensions over the surface of a trap and have them move in 2D. And the reason for that is that, you know, there are reasonably good quantum error correcting codes that are local in 2D. And as long as the qubits actually live in 2D, you can implement those with an amount of memory error per, you know, say, layer of gates that is system size independent, which you would want to have, you know, error correcting threshold. So, yeah, at the end of the day, basically, I agree with you. And everybody's plan, I think, in the trapped ion community is to move toward 2D, and that's what we're currently working on.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Are there any questions online? I just want to make sure we... people. Otherwise, I think we have time for one more question in the back.
So you said to perform the cooling as well as the shuttling, you actually have two ions like paired to each other, essentially. So one of them is the actual qubit, and one's like an auxiliary one that you use to like... my worry was, how do you know that you're not going to get some sort of non-Markovian error from having some system that could be entangled to your qubit that's sort of persisting? Because every qubit essentially has another system adjacent to it that plausibly could have some sort of quantum memory. Have you performed any sort of analysis of if that's like happening, how you could mitigate it?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think, we've thought about this in a lot of detail. The first thing is, you know, we cool the sympathetic coolant before all rounds of gates. And so I would say there's actually, it's pretty credible, I think, that there's no real room for non-Markovian type stuff to go on because of that. Like that coupling to the coolant ion could cause an error, but there would be no memory of like, you know, the state of that coolant ion after the round of cooling. It's basically like perfectly prepared back to a particular state. So I don't think there's much fear or reasonable fear of non-Markovian errors because of that. I think you could worry about it causing errors, entanglement between the qubit and the ion. And the reason that doesn't happen is that we're basically just very careful to make sure that any processes like that are far off resonant. And we kind of model that, and that's, you know, that would be included if it showed up at any appreciable level in our understanding of the gate error. But it is, in the way we currently do gates, it's a very small effect.
Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah. I think maybe we could take more questions offline. We're out of time, but thank you, Mike, again.